Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. You are not alone.
Today we have Ryan Bell and Terry Campbell to speak about Seventh-day Adventists. So Ryan and Terry, thank you so much for being here and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Cool. Well, thanks for being had, you two. That's been great.
Bye.
See you all next week. I must confess, I have no idea of what the Seventh-day Adventists believe in. I struggle to even pronounce the name of the religion. So I'm so ready to be educated by both of you. But before we jump in, do you guys want to tell the audience a bit more about yourselves? What is it that you do? Where do you come from? All those nice details.
Sure. Hi, guys. My name is Terry Gamble. I am an actor person in LA based here in this box of Zoom. I'm also a podcast host, a horror movie survival guide. I talk about scary movies every week with people. I'm a tabletop role play gamer on Twitch. So I stream, which is why I got the gamer chair. Cool. Yeah, I met Ryan years ago, like a million years ago, it feels like now. And we were both in the Adventist church, but he was actually not just in it. He was my pastor back in the day. Sending it over to Ryan.
Hey, everyone. Great to see you. Great to be here with you. I, as Terry said, used to be a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. I was my folks were something else when I was born, but by the time I was about 6 or 7, I was going to the Adventist church with my family. I see some of you in the chat were raised Adventist as well. Currently, I am a tenants' rights organizer in Southern California. I work for a statewide tenants' rights organization called Tenants Together. I have a podcast called Life After God. Yeah, I do a bunch of other things as well. Very involved in my in politics in my town of Pasadena, California. Maybe you have seen the Rose Parade.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You know what I miss doing? I miss kind of reading out the poll question. Do you mind if I kind of do that now? Okay.
Let's do it.
So Terry and Ryan kind of put together these three questions. And the first is, who is the prophet of the Seventh-day Adventist Church? And you have several options: Joseph Smith, Mary Baker Eddy, Ellen G. White, and Jesus Christ. And 49% of the folks said Ellen G. White. Question number two: when you think of Seventh-day Adventists, what is the first thing that comes to mind? I don't know anything about them. They're vegetarians. They go to church on a weird day. They think Jesus is coming very soon. They don't drink or smoke. And the top answer so far is they go to church on a weird day, with 34% or 39% folks saying that. The third question is, which of the following is or was not a tenet or rule of the Seventh-day Adventist culture? Members may not receive blood transfusions. Members are not allowed to wear jewelry or makeup. Members should not play cards, or members should not go to the movie theater, any theater. And 64% of the folks said they may not receive transfusions as one of the tenets that the Seventh-day Adventists don't have. So yeah, that's the poll questions. Those are pretty good.
Yeah, everybody did well.
Yeah.
I think the majority got all of them, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, one is more of an opinion question. But.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But well, let's kind of get into this. Terry, you want to tell us about your coming out story, like how you became an SDA and how you got out of it?
Well, I was born in, basically. I mean, like, from, you know, my parents still heavily involved, and I, as they call, are dedicated. It's kind of like a christening, I think, on the Catholic Church, kind of like equivalent, where like you're dedicated when you're born, and then like you're raised that way and baptized, you know, at like 10 years old. And continue on. I used to teach in the youth classes. I was very involved from pretty much my whole life, and taught and did all that kind of stuff. And then life happens, and all the things I wanted to do were things I wasn't allowed to do. Like when I thought the Mormons were really progressive, I feel like that gives you a little bit of frame of space of how much more conservative Adventism can be. I really wanted to dance and I wanted to perform, and those things were all not allowed. There was no, at that point, theater departments or film departments or anything in that vein related. When I was applying to colleges, I ended up at UCLA and studying theater, luckily. But that was not where a lot of people in my family or even in my church who had really wanted me to go. They really wanted me to go to an Adventist school, but I was like, they don't have anything I want to do. And it's not super supported by the church. Also around that time, I realized that I was not necessarily straight. And that was also a problem with the church. So I went on kind of an adventure and went to college and traveled Europe and just started questioning. And I did what I call like one of my favorite movies is Sweet Charity. I love that she goes to like the Religion of the Month Club, and she literally goes to like the main character goes to like different churches. And I was like, I'm Charity right now. Like, I'm going to try everything. And I went to so many different churches. I tried literally the gamut from Eastern to Western, like all these different styles. Went to visit anyone who would take me with them someplace to a different church. Eventually got a little bit more rooted back in the church, actually around the time I met Ryan, because I had kind of left for a little while. But I had a partner at the time who also was just really wanting to reconnect with God in some way. And she'd been raised Catholic, but I was looking for a place that was accepting. Ryan had this amazing church that I ended up at that was like very open and accepting. And it was small, but loving. So I ended up there, and that's where we met and became friends. And then eventually I moved out of LA area and was living back east, and ended up going to grad school and traveling to Europe and living in Russia and being there and actually traveling again. What, for better or worse, getting perspective outside of America, I think is super helpful as to how religious America is. And it is eye-opening to be in a place in another place where it just doesn't make the same kind of sense because it's not so ingrained culturally. And during that time, I kind of had that realization. I remember being in church being like, is everyone praying at the same time? It must be really loud and noisy to be God. And then also realizing that everybody in that room is literally practicing their religion in a different way. As many people as there are on the planet, that's how many religions there are, because no one can keep all exact same tenets. Even if you're kind of in the same vein, you're never all going to believe the exact same things. And that's when I was like, oh, we all have made up something. This is all made up. I think I'm good. I'm out. And then not too long after that, I saw Ryan start this blog. And I was like, what? Ryan? So I reached out to him and I was like, you're out too? Let's talk. So anyway, I'll leave it to Ryan now to give his little two bits.
Yeah, that day really sticks in my mind. I mean, it's one of those days where you can like, you remember what you like. We met for breakfast at this cute little cafe in Atwater Village. And I remember the cafe. I remember what I ate. I remember everything about that day. As I mentioned, I was more or less raised in the church, and I was a really spiritual kid, I would say. I was like weirdly interested at a very young age in like meaning and where the universe came from and, you know, all that stuff. And because I had religious family, the answers that I received as a child were religious answers. And I was raised in the church, and it was overall a really positive experience for me. It provided me an opportunity to make a difference in whatever small way, or at least in my mind, I felt like I was making a difference. So I went through a lot of different twists and turns in my college career to figure out what I wanted to do professionally, and ended up settling on pastoral ministry. Yeah, lots of sort of counterfactuals about that. Like, what would life be like if I had done something else? But if I can say, like, I was good at it. Like, I'm good at building relationships with people and connecting people in community and creating space for people to be creative within that space and to think about what their lives can mean to each other and to the world that they live in and all of that. And so I had my own very long journey from being rather conservative, raised in the church, to being, you know, gradually less conservative, I would say, and ended up in 2005 in Hollywood, where I very soon after that met Terry and her then partner. And it was really soon after I moved there, actually, that they came to the church, and I was super psyched because they looked like normal people, like just people I would meet on the street and just in my daily life, as opposed to, you know, church people have a kind of look, you know, kind of a particular church ladies or like
Adventists especially. It's because it's part of the tenets of like need to dress like you're prepared to meet God that day. So it's like, I mean, the outfits are very particular, especially depending on which coast you're at. Because I also, after spending time on some of the East Coast, it's way more button up. Like people tend to wear, you know, like suit and tie, and like you think of the Sunday best, it's like Saturday best for Seventh-day Adventists. People do have a certain vibe and look that they want to. A modesty as well is very encouraged. So,
what was like the crack that's kind of started forming for you that sort of pushed you out?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were so many cracks. I would say there were like three or four big ones. I remember as a very, very conservative late high school, early college, I can't remember, reading The Chosen by Chaim Potok. And I don't know if any of you have read that novel, but in it, a young man named Reuven is beginning to question his Hasidic roots and family. And he begins to sneak off to the library and read Freud. Which was like highly, highly forbidden. And it just opens a whole new world to him. And there's actually a series of novels that are, in that sort of same vein with the same characters. And then I think as I entered pastoral ministry later in my life, I just met lots of people who didn't fit the mold, you know, that I was taught as a fundamentalist Adventist.
Oh, okay.
You know, so people who were, you know, would smoke, you know, and I had won't take the time now, but I have a story about one of my deacons who would secretly smoke cigarettes, and he came to me one day and wanted to resign his membership, and he felt that that was something he had to do as a smoker, and I told him to forget about it. And then I thought about it later, like, why did I tell him to forget about it? Like, why didn't I accept his resignation? And I didn't realize at the time, but looking back, I realized in my life that I was consistently prioritizing people over the dogma. But not all at once. Like, I would never have accepted all people, but at that moment, the smoker was okay for me. Later in life, a family joined my church who had a gay son and who had not come to church in a long time. And I just remember thinking, well, that's crazy. Like, he should come to church. Like, where else would you go to find answers about who you are and what your life should be like and all of that? So eventually those decisions led to tension within the church hierarchy, to the point where I was eventually, asked to leave. I like to say that I was told that I wasn't a Seventh-day Adventist anymore and that I was the last one to find out. and I really reluctantly agreed, you know, I really did love the work I was doing and the people I was doing it with. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the church's official like response to LGBTQ plus community? Is it like tolerating them but not fully accepting them? Is it or should I say us tolerating us but not fully accepting us? Is it completely rejecting the idea that if you're not straight, then, you know, what would be their position?
Yeah, you're gonna go to hell.
Okay.
I mean, pretty
great.
It's love it. I mean, and it's also like, I mean, there, I mean, obviously we have our share of like choir directors and like, you know, all the people that are all the usual suspects are, you know, still part of the church, but it's definitely not supported and it's definitely frowned upon. And in certain circles, it can get you kicked out depending on the church, but it's definitely mm-hmm. not something that people are excited to share or supportive of necessarily.
Yeah, it definitely is differed by church, right? Like,
yeah.
And most churches, there tends to be a line within Adventism, whether it's around women or LGBT people, that they will tolerate you being in the pew. Mm-hmm. But you can't talk about who you are and you certainly can't express yourself. And
it's like, don't ask, don't tell is what I equate it to, you know?
And you can't have a leadership role.
No.
Unless it's completely hidden who you are and nobody's figured it out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's very common in like different religions that we have touched on. So, I can't say I'm surprised really, but yeah, that sounds pretty bad. So what are other beliefs that the Seventh-day Adventists share that maybe are different from your average Christianity sort of way?
Well, the two big ones are in the name of the church, the Seventh-day Adventists. And so Seventh-day, the church observes the Sabbath on Saturday as Jews do. And then the Adventist part is about the soon coming of Jesus. So from the 1840s, 1830s, when the church first got its sort of the proto-Adventists, if you will, the early people who became Adventists, were very much into interpreting Bible prophecy, but none of them had actual degrees or knowledge about the Bible or you know, the original languages. And so they were just, it was just, you know, in some ways I respect it. It was just ordinary people approaching the text, which I think should be celebrated in a way. Like, I don't think you have to be a Shakespeare scholar to read Shakespeare. So, in the same way, people were approaching the Bible with this very humble approach. And they began interpreting prophecy and saying Jesus was going to come back in 1844. And then from 1443 and then 1844. And then it was a specific day in 1844, October 22nd. And, you know, and so it was very much rush, rush, rush. Let's get ready. We have to be ready for Jesus to return. And then ever after that, you know, I always say spoiler alert, you know, Jesus didn't come.
Jesus didn't come.
Just in case.
So shocking.
And then they were like, hold on, hold on. Okay, so Jesus didn't come. But what happened was, is that, okay, so you know that there's like, Jesus is doing the judgment up in the sky. So he's gone down from like, you know how there's like the temple that, like, you know, back in the Old Testament where they were going through the desert and like, you know, they had different sections of the temple. Basically, the spiritual temple up in the sky, they've gone from the holy place to the most holy place. So the judgment is actually taken to the next level is basically what's happening. So it's not that Jesus didn't come. It's that he's actually moving in heaven to another place.
Right.
Right.
It's total sense.
And do
totally
they
make sense.
In the apocalypse, like the end of the world, you know, when Jesus comes.
Oh yeah,
comes,
there's end times and there are hard end times people, which is why I think that also right now, the political landscape, I find it very interesting for those who are pushing for like an apocalypse or for like, well, everything just has to be bad because it's the end and this is what's happening. So like Ben Carson in the United States, who was he's, you know, part of Trump's cabinet. And he actually is an Adventist. He was actually a very prominent Adventist. And so to see that ideology finally meet up with politics is very interesting because Adventists historically had kind of a conscientious objector, like weren't part of like government in that way, really stayed away from it. There's a whole movie, Hacksaw Ridge, with Andrew, I think it was whatever, came out a few years ago. It was one of like another Adventist story from back in the day, hero that went kind of mainstream. You can kind of see how dogmatic it was if you watch that film of what somebody was as far as not wanting to have any type of military affiliation and not having any type of political. But things have changed as the world's kind of come to what they think is the end. And I think they've gotten more involved with that to help push to that end right now. And that's actually kind of scary at the moment.
So Jesus moved from one place in heaven to another place back in 1844. Did he hire two angels in a chariot or something to do this whole moving thing?
Well, apparently, it's funny that you should ask that, and I know it's tongue in cheek, but actually, we were, you know, one theory is that the throne has wheels.
what?
I really shouldn't be laughing. I apologize.
No, it's okay.
It's okay. It's kind of funny.
I've seen like a video of a lazy boy that was hooked up to like a lawnmower or something.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think they had to find a way to justify the date without facing this devastating disappointment. So yeah, you come up with a workaround. And so ever after that, like we've lived, Terry and I and all other Adventists have lived with this idea for nearly 200 years that Jesus is coming back any minute.
So you gotta be ready and you need to be prepared. That's the constant call is be ready, be prepared. And another big call is it's at Matthew, is it 25 or something like that in the New Testament, the three angels message or whatever, like you have to get the word out to the whole world. Once every ear has heard the message of Jesus, that's when Jesus is going to come, which is why when you see, like, I know people are very upset about that last tribe that has not been touched by any other person, and people keep going to try to proselytize to these people, trying to find that last group of people on the planet.
Wow. Okay.
That's a big thing in people's minds of like, they have to meet and find those people because every ear needs to know about and hear about Jesus so that Jesus can come. So when people are like, why are they going there? They're just taking diseases and are probably going to wipe these people out if you go try to go find this last untouched tribe. It's because it's like they've been told you have to find and speak to every person. They can't leave these people alone because that's the only way Jesus will come.
Yeah.
Now, this sounds like you were saying this kind of started in the 1840s, and Mormonism started about that time too.
They're
in the same area in Pennsylvania? That kind
upstate of upstate New York. Yeah.
Upstate New York. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's a time in history known as the Second Great Awakening.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of millennial fever, this idea that Jesus was coming back. It swept through, you know, Methodists, Episcopalians. And actually most of the Adventist founders were disaffected Methodists, and some were Christian Connection, which doesn't exist anymore. Some were deists, actually, as, you know, some of our founding fathers who, the right wing likes to say were Christians, or, you know, believers, and that they have, you know, put God into our government's founding documents. You know, they were mostly deists who believed that there was kind of a watchmaker God, you know, that made the watch and wound it up and walked away. So a lot of the converts to Adventism were actually early American deists, who were swept up in this, if you can picture like circuit riding preachers, you know, riding across the country, like with this urgent, urgent message that Jesus was coming soon. And it caught fire. Charles Finney, in Ohio and New York, Oberlin College was born out of a lot of that energy. The Moody, Bible Institute, Dwight L. Moody, was sort of part of that same.
And then all the Kellogg stuff eventually.
Yeah,
the Kellogg stuff.
Kellogg, you know, your cornflakes are Adventist.
Really?
Yeah, and all the they're really into health and wellness. So, like the whole like kind of modern health and wellness movement has also got its roots heavily tied into Adventism as well. So, a lot of those things were invented and created in a way we're trying to avoid unhealthful foods and things of that nature. So. Adventists are really into health, doctor stuff. There's a lot of Adventist nurses and doctors. Like most, like a good portion of them go into the medical field in some way, shape, or form.
Wow, that was back in the 1860s or so with Kellogg.
Adventists still live very long. There's actually an enclave in Loma Linda, California, and they have the longest lifespan in the U.S. Wow. Because they don't drink, don't smoke, and believe that Jesus is coming any day. They also don't believe in like ghosts as we speak, like as in like ghosts are going to, can I get to you? They believe that once people die, they're in the ground. And when they're going to come back is when Jesus comes again. So there's not a fear of like, oh, I die. That's it. They just kind of have that thing like, okay, I just get to live this long, beautiful life. And then the next time I wake up, that's going to be when Jesus comes to get me out of the ground.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of Jesus coming again, like from what I understood, Kellogg kind of accidentally or put this whole like health spa together to help people or to avoid masturbating.
Yeah.
That was one of the pieces. Like there was, I mean, it's interesting because I think at the time Kellogg was sort of in the vanguard of the medical profession of his day, which isn't saying a lot by today's standards, but the Battle Creek Sanitarium was sort of such a flagship institution at the time that I believe it was President Grover Cleveland was treated there, under Kellogg's, care. Hmm. And then he eventually left the church, famously became a pantheist. And so he sort of embraced the idea that God is in everything, a much more expansive understanding of that, you know, God's in the sky and in the trees and in the rocks and which is to say, like, there's not like a personal God the way that most Christians think of God. So that's a big scandal in the Adventist church. It was his brother who really pioneered the cornflakes, and they were, they've become much tastier, I understand.
they added sugar.
Yeah. I think in the 1850s and 60s, it was a little, you know, tough
more
and bland.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really hard. Like,
But, you know, eventually, like, Adventists, we do a lot of potlucks, and a lot of people are vegetarian. That also came out of the health message as well, too.
Okay.
A lot of Adventists you meet are vegetarian. If you go to an Adventist hospital, you're going to be served a vegetarian food. A lot of people are shocked and surprised sometimes, but they end up at one, and they're like, what? Yes. So there's like, you know, tons of recipes with cornflakes. Like, even at Thanksgiving, my mom will make patties like out of them. And like, there's like whole casserole recipes. So we're very into getting together and having potlucks and fellowshipping over food, because we don't drink and we don't smoke and we don't dance, but everybody likes to eat. So we get together and talk and chat over meals. So that's pretty common, in the church, I think.
Is it mandatory to be vegetarian, or is it like recommended or encouraged?
Recommended and encouraged, but definitely not mandatory.
What is more mandatory is the sort of the Jewish dietary restrictions, but not all of them, only some of them. Well, actually, I guess maybe all of the dietary restrictions, but not kosher. So we wouldn't care if your hamburger came in contact with dairy, or that you use the same skillet for both. But what we would not eat when I was growing up, shrimp or any seafood or pork, that kind of thing. And you know, even until just recently, I just didn't have the taste for shrimp at all. And I know a lot of people perhaps don't, regardless. But it was just, I never grew up eating any of that. Bacon and pepperoni, on the other hand, came to me rather naturally.
I got that at my babysitter's house, and I was like, "What is this?" as a kid, because weren't allowed that at home. So yeah, so there's no. Yeah.
Do they have a specific place of worship? Is it like your average church, or is it any different? And also, apart from the Bible, do they use any other holy book?
Say the church is pretty much like any other kind of, like, I think, you know, Protestant church in America, as far as the look of it. Some of them will have crosses out front. A lot of them don't. It's not like they look kind of like everything else. We even had, in my church growing up, we had a Sunday church that rented from our church that used the same space.
Really?
That was a good way to make revenue. I think a lot of churches actually do that, because it's like, instead of having to pay for your own. Yeah, we had a Sunday church that met there as well.
At our church in Hollywood, where Terry and I met, we had probably four at a time renting from us.
I guess if the church is not open or nobody's there on Sundays.
And everyone else, the dominant culture is Sunday worshiping. You have this big space. It looks exactly the same. So you'd see out front of my church growing up, the sign for the Sunday and then sign for Saturday. Huh. And then Wednesday nights, you know, if you have Wednesday night prayer meetings or things like that. But no, pretty much that's pretty standard. You can talk about the books, Ryan. How about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, officially it's just the Bible. You know, we in the quiz at the beginning, we talked about Ellen White being the prophet of the Adventist Church. And they do refer to her as a prophet in the same way that Mormons would talk about Joseph Smith. There is a little difference that, if you wanted to split hairs, I think a difference between the way Mormons think about Joseph Smith and the way Adventists think about Ellen White. Ellen White, in her writings, always said that she was not equal to the Bible. But in practice, conservative Adventists will kind of place her at or above the Bible. And it's kind of easy to understand why, because the Bible was written so long ago, and Ellen White wrote in the 1840s and 50s and 60s. And so it's just natural to turn to someone who claims to be able to interpret that for you in modern language. Of course, by the time Terry and I read that stuff, it wasn't modern anymore. It was 100 years old or more. But it's definitely, we would use this kind of sun and moon analogy for Ellen White in relationship to the Bible. So it was, you know, God is the sun, and the Bible is more the original source of light. And then Ellen White was like a prominent reflection of that light, more so than you or me. So not as big as the Bible, but certainly more insightful and more inspired than any one of us.
Right.
Is there a specific version of the Bible, like that is doctrine, or
pushed on King James as a kid? And then as I got older, it was kind of like New Revised Standard, I think, is what I remember reading a lot. But I had six different Bibles.
Yeah, I was King James as a kid. But it wasn't like a lot of super fundamentalist Bible churches that you'll drive by and you'll see the sign out front, and they'll say Bible believing, or they'll say KJV only right on their sign out front of their church. So it was never like, I mean, I had members in my various churches that I was the pastor of who were determined that I was preaching a false gospel because I was preaching from the NIV, the New International Version.
Whoa, but it was never really?
Like, yeah, like the word was wrong. Like, and if you get that word translated wrong, you know, and in actual fact, the King James Version translates more of it wrong because the scholarships just improve in that amount of time. And so some people just like it because it's the King's English, you know, kind of thing. And I memorized scripture. I'm sure Terry did too. And sometimes when I would quote back scripture, it would be in the King James Version because that's how I learned it.
Like Bible decathlons were definitely a thing. Like I think a little bit about that. So like we had our own group that's called the Pathfinders. It's a scouting group that's similar to Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, but it's a co-ed group. So we would have it was groups together. So I was in Pathfinders from the time before I was eligible to, because my mom was the Pathfinder leader at my church growing up. So I did it from the time I was like 4 or 5 years old till I was like 16. So like I have a ton of patches and like all that stuff where you have to do all of that. But we would have like Bible decathlons and compete against other kids like at big camperies. So there's still big like camperies and get-togethers with all these kids that are done in the church. I also went to Adventist school for a good portion of my life. And there's a lot of Adventist schools from the whole way through your whole education. You can have just be an Adventist school. And I know a lot of kids that did that. My brother did almost all of that from kindergarten through college and university. So there's a lot of emphasis on really getting the and being indoctrinated from Sabbath school on Saturday, your school week during the week, Wednesday nights if you need it. Also, Pathfinder group on the weekends or on like Saturday night, we had a thing called AY, which is like Adventist youth get-togethers when the sun would go down. Instead of going straight out to go party because you're not supposed to, they kind of want to break you down and in. And like after the sun goes down, because our Sabbath was Friday sunset to Saturday sunset. So we weren't allowed to go out on Friday night. So we'd either get together with friends and sit and sing. Yeah. So like high school was the worst. So like everyone's like, what are you doing? It's like, I'm going home, like to sit with my parents and not do anything. My dad's going to turn off the TV and we're going to have to play like Jesus music the rest of the night and like not go out. Only exceptions I got was if I was doing a show because my parents were cool enough to let me go do a couple of theater shows. But other than that, even like football games, I went to one football game a year. It's when my choir had to sing the national anthem. And then I would go home after I sang so I wouldn't be there for the game.
Wow. Locked you down.
Yeah.
Pause. Let's take a moment of silence that I did not go to my prom. Probably
Are you
Terry
kidding?
Didn't either. No, it was on Friday night.
I went.
Oh, you went?
Mine was on Saturday because I helped plan it.
I wasn't going to be allowed to go to my high school graduation because it was after sundown on a Friday.
Oh, no.
And school, actually, I went to a very small high school and they changed the time of graduation for me. And of course, my grandparents, who I lived with at the time, really emphasized that this was like a Daniel moment, you know, where I stood up for my beliefs and the powers that be changed to accommodate, you know, my beliefs, which meant you know, God really smiled on my courage.
So how far awful. Back in your families did SDA go? It sounds like your grandparents, Ryan, were SDAs.
Yeah.
What about you, Terry? Like, where did it kind of start in your family?
It was my parents and actually my dad. He was in foster care and the family that took in him and a bunch of his siblings was actually Adventist. So he owed a lot to that family he's one of 10 kids and they took in a bunch of the kids. He had a really hard upbringing, like, you know, concrete floors and a potbelly stove kind of upbringing in like, you know, rural Indiana. Like they were the kids that got the gift baskets, you know, for Christmas from the fire department. Really, really rough. And the family that took him in were kind and had really good work ethic and were super sweet and were also Adventists. And so that's where he still feels like he owes a lot to them. And he's also a really, really insanely smart person. He's got a master's in education. He's one of just like those people who's just always thinking ahead. And there's something about Adventism. I find a lot of people who really like to study love it because it's one of those religions where they love it. If you have a lesson every week, you don't just go to church and sit there and like get here and then leave. Like they expect you to be an active participant. You get a thing that's called the quarterly. It's like basically like your like lesson plans for every quarter. And you get this thing that's provided by the actual church. They have a whole union that put it together. my mom's been writing a bunch for her personal church during this pandemic. She's actually been writing her own like lesson studies each week and stuff too. So it's all got to have stuff from the Bible. You can have a combination sometimes of stuff from Ellen too, depending on the people. But it's a lot of study, a lot of answers. So people who love school tend to, I think, gravitate towards that church. It's like people who like to be like, sing and get crazy, find those churches. Do you know what I mean? Though I feel like people find what vibes with them and makes sense in their lives. And my dad loves to read. And I think that's why he really loves the church. And my mom also too.
So he's still an Adventist, your father?
Oh yeah. And my mom.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned proselytizing. Did you get trained for it during like teenage years, childhood? Or is it something that is more like voluntary and it's just like, if
want
to, I know you mentioned that
you do it.
That
it's not like Mormonism where we take off on a mission and you like have a whole time to go out and do that. But no, it's definitely encouraged. And we definitely did things like where we would have nights like with AY, what they call like in gathering or whatever, where you'd go and you get your pamphlets and like go knock on doors, you know, as like the sun's going down and go like try to go talk to people and invite them to church. Oh yeah. We would do that on weekends.
Say I was also trained to do that. I did take a mission. It's optional. You know, you can find a way to do it, but I took a year out of college and went to the Philippines for a year and basically taught English and did and preached in different churches that I would travel to on the weekend.
Oh yeah, I would go to Mexico as a kid on the weekends. We would go work like in an orphanage or like go like on trips. Like they have a big trip they go every year. The church I grew up going to still goes to like parts of New Mexico to like different communities and like, yeah, let's do a lot of outreach and different islands. So a lot of Adventists all over like the Pacific Islands and some of the harder hit places that'll go do like dentistry missions. Cause like I said, a lot of people are doctors and nurses in the church. They'll go offer their medical services and take volunteers to go help with that.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. Yeah. I had no idea how this is great. This is great.
The Adventists are everywhere. They're all over the world, all over Africa. Yeah. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I wanted to be a missionary because they do have missionaries, just not, it's not required, but it's definitely encouraged. Cause like when I was like 4 or 5, I want to be a doctor. Then I was like, no, I want to travel. So I'll be a missionary doctor, like go places. I still ended up traveling, but I didn't have to do the missionary work. So that worked out.
Yeah.
My uncle is a dentist and for years they would travel to the Marshall Islands and do dentistry in the Marshall Islands, which if you remember your history was an island that was relentlessly bombed by the United States in its atom bomb testing phases. And those people have just been so brutalized. And so, there were a lot of mission efforts to go to the Chuck Islands and Marshall Islands and to provide medical and dental care.
And what are some of the struggles of the people within the religion in terms of, for example, you mentioned before that people who are from the LGBTQ plus, they're not accepted. I'm going to assume that women in leadership isn't like the greatest, the most accepted idea. Is there any other
minorities? Accepted. It's that if you're a female, you cannot be ordained as a minister officially.
Okay.
It's been a big point of contention, at least I know for the last 10 years, especially that conversation has been more at the forefront because there has been a bigger push because as people have been kind of leaving, I think a lot of different religions, but especially leaving our church, you know, the women have been filling in the gaps and the fact that women still can't get ordained to continue that work has been a real struggle. I know for some folks that have wanted to, you know, that they felt that they were called and then they were shunned away. There is a group called the Dorcas, which was one of the characters in the Bible, too, that was a lady who was very helpful to people. And they have a whole ministry that these women do that's basically like the women kind of like community, like everything from food pantries to like helping, you know, sick and shut in people who are needing additional support. They do a lot of this type of work. Now it's kind of like equivalent to the nuns in like a Catholic church, I would say, as far as like kind of like their space that they hold. And a lot of these women do want more, want to do more for the church, but are not really allowed to.
Mm-hmm. So what's the like hierarchy, the structure of the church? How does it, you know, what's the different like levels of importance that you can be in church?
Like the Catholics have got the Pope and then, you
sure.
know, Cardinals, yeah. bishops, whatever.
It's interesting because the Adventist Church has sort of defined itself over against Catholics, among other groups. You know, that there's a strong anti-Catholic a bias within the Adventist Church. So much so that, you know, as Martin Luther said, you know, that the Pope was the Antichrist. I mean, there are, you know, that's part of Adventist biblical interpretation as well. So ironically, the structure of the Adventist Church resembles the Catholic structure quite a lot. So there's a world church. And because the church was founded in the United States, that exists in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's called the General Conference. And then there are, unions, which are like regional bodies, usually over several states, if it's the United States, or several countries, if it's Europe and Africa and, Asia. And then within those, there are conferences, which is like the smallest judicatory body. And under the conferences, there are churches. So yeah, it's a pretty complex, structure.
And even within that, though, there's also like the weird racism in between too, because within conferences, like I know living in Maryland, it was like, there was definitely the Black conference versus kind of like the white conference too.
Yeah.
So the church segregated within it,
So during civil rights, and as African Americans in the United States began to gain more civil rights, they couldn't break through in the church the way they were breaking through in the general population. And so Black leadership said, basically, screw it. We're going to start our own system so that we can advance in our ministry the way that white people do. And then, you know, of course, as you might imagine, now it's a little embarrassing that we have these separate conferences. And so every time it comes up, at least when I was still a part of the church, the conversation would invariably be, we need to get rid of these regional, euphemistically, they were referred to as regional conferences, but essentially, like Terry said, Black conferences. Anytime it was considered that we should reintegrate, it was always the Black conferences that needed to disband and join in back in with Mother Church, so to speak. So it was never that there needed to be some other kind of mechanism for that. I also wanted to just mention too, when you were asking about people who don't fit in, I think the church has historically had a hard time with its scientists, because the church believes in a strict, young age of the earth and 6 day literal creation. But what's weird about the Adventist Church, as Terry mentioned, is there's a huge emphasis on education. So you have this like university system that's, you know, rivaled only by the Catholics, that, you know, you have colleges. I mean, the Mormons have BYU. The Adventist Church has, I think, 8 or 9 full-scale universities in the United States. Huge emphasis on education. And so a lot, and because of the science emphasis that Terry mentioned, the doctors and nurses and other medical, allied health professions, you have a lot of people that go in and get some basic science background. Well, you get a little basic science background, and some people want to become geologists and archaeologists. And then they discover that, gosh, the earth seems to be older than we've been saying all along. And so the church started this Geoscience Research Institute, which is essentially their sort of message control system where certain scientists try to make arguments for creation. And then I think the other group that tends to have a tough time are just free thinkers in general. People who interpret the Bible differently tend to be outcasts.
It seems like this is very like a very Christian kind of religion, like they base it on Jesus, they have their God, like most Christians do. Do they communicate with their deity any differently, or is it prayer? You know, like most of us prayer. Are used to.
It's prayer, just a lot of like quiet prayer. There's no like speaking in tongues or anything like that. That's actually frowned upon, or thought of as like kind of crazy. It's really quiet. We have a lot of quiet hour, quiet prayer. Now you'll silently pray while we all get together. Or one person will lead a prayer, but there's no like, you know, obviously the Lord's Prayer and things like that, but there's no like prayer book or anything like that of prayers.
Can adherents talk directly to their deity, or do they have to
there's go, you don't have to go through like an in-between or something like that. Your prayers go directly to God. That's what I was saying. It's like about the being loud when I was like, all of us are silently praying, but it's quiet in here, but it's gotta be loud if you're God. That's what I because people would have silent prayer request time, you know, that was pretty common.
Another strand of the religion that comes from the Quakers. So, I mean, I think a lot of that silence and quietude comes from that sort of strain as well.
Someone in the comments is asking, what about people with no internal monologue? Which is a really interesting question. I've never thought about that, but yeah. Is that ever discussed in church? I would assume it isn't, but is it?
I can't. Mine is so loud and noisy, I can't get it to shut up. So yeah. yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there is a devotional quality to Bible reading and journaling and reading other devotional books like the writings of Ellen White or non-prophetic writers who just have kind of inspiring things to say about God or whatever. So those are also devotional works. It's not equal to the Bible. It's not the same as praying, but was encouraged. And so I think you could have your quiet time and also nature. In some circles, you know, there was an emphasis on nature being God's second book, like the second way God communicates with us, like reveals his love to us through the beauty of the natural world. And so,
oh yeah, nature walks were big. Like huge, I also worked at summer camp because I worked at an Adventist camp and went there from the time I was like 7 and then worked there till I was like 16 or 17. So every summer I was with, again, Adventist kids during school and then at church and then to summer camp. And summer camp was a big place where a lot of people would do, they would push you really hard, I think, at summer camp to make sure that you got baptized. That was like a real decision-making space. So we did a thing called Walk Through the Bible every Saturday afternoon on Sabbath. So we would set up little vignettes and scenes like out in nature, straight ripped from the Bible, you know, headlines, so to speak, and make like little, like, that was my like acting outlet though. Cause I was like, oh, we get to go like make scenes out here and like, you know, be like these people, characters out of the Bible in the middle of nature. And it was really an opportunity to commune. I loved camp though. That was like one of the highlights for sure though.
Yeah, you know, that's why I became a Christian. I gave my heart to Jesus at summer camp.
Me too. That's where they send you.
Right.
I came back from camp. I was like, I got to get baptized now.
Exactly.
I loved going up in the mountains and the pine trees and going hiking. And like, for me, I loved nature. And so if I would always go to this Christian camp. And so I kind of conflated my love for nature with this like feeling of attachment to Jesus or God or something like that. It was weird because I had to kind of unravel that years later as like, no, I love nature and it has nothing to do with a God or Jesus for me. And it was sneaky. It was really psychologically sneaky, I think.
Yeah. You do have to unwire that somehow, those linkages and even prayer. I find like, I think there's a kind of self-talk that happens when you're praying. I mean, if you have an atheist perspective, all prayer is self-talk, right? But I think from a Christian perspective, I can reflect on, I would literally, when I was in college, I would go on these nature walks every morning, sometimes even before the sun came up and, take a walk, see, you know, and I would talk to God or Jesus, whomever, as if they were right beside me, sometimes even out loud, which is, I think, you know, for some people, maybe like borderline crazy. For other people, though, I think it's a way of sorting out your thoughts.
It's like meditation. I think like, you know, for those who have a meditation practice, that was something I took up later because I was just like, I still feel that need to kind of ground and center myself. But I feel like I'm also do improv. And when we get together, we do centering, you know, talks together and something to kind of get us on the same wavelength. And I think that's kind of just your day to check in with yourself in that time. Yeah. I think it's very akin to that. I don't think that's out of the ordinary, so to speak.
Yeah.
In the world.
There's something about kind of like hearing your own voice, which helps process some of the internal thoughts even better for some people.
Right.
I know that my wife like talks when she's kind of doing something, she talks to herself and I'm like, oh, okay. I make fun of her every now and then because it's fun, but that's just kind of how she processes and her brain works.
One thing I definitely want to ask you is, what are the unique challenges that people face when they leave the religion? And then specifically, what was like difficult for you personally, if you want to share that, of course, if you're uncomfortable, that's also fine. But what was personally difficult for you when coming out of religion? And do you have any tips for friends of someone who is leaving the religion to help them? Is there any way that, you know, we can hopefully make that process a bit easier?
I think, you know, every religion is about community, you know, at its core, I think. But if you think about the ways in which evangelicals will move from church to church, or like a Presbyterian will go to a Methodist church if they move to a new town, and then maybe the Methodist church sucks and they like the Presbyterian preacher better. But I think there are three groups of people that don't migrate like that. Jews, and then among Christians, Catholics and Adventists. Like, if you're a Catholic, you're a Catholic. You don't just become a Baptist. Like, that's a big, you do, but it's a big deal. Like, you make a very conscious choice. I am no longer Catholic. I'm now Baptist. But I think Baptists will go to, like, I don't know, all kinds of different churches, depending on, or a non-denominational thing became really popular in the 80s and 90s. Adventists never did. I mean, I always used to say, like, an Adventist will go to a very, very bad Adventist church because it's the only one in town. Like, they will go to the shittiest church ever, you know, because it's Adventist. They won't just go to the Presbyterian church because it's Saturday and Sunday, for one thing. And it's a very tight-knit group. And so when you leave, you really are leaving a tight community. And I would never want to claim that it was like leaving Judaism, because I think that's even tighter, especially as I've talked to a number of people who have left Orthodox and other very ultra-conservative Jewish contexts. There was just an article in the New York Times, actually, about that and people losing their kids, you know, if they leave the Orthodox community. But it's, yeah, I lost all my friends. Not all of them, but like 90-something percent of them. And even the ones that I didn't lose because of the religion thing, it was just, I wasn't in their orbit anymore. Like, you know how you just sort of fall out of touch with people. You see them every week and then you don't see them anymore. And you just are like, how many of those relationships can I really maintain? So that's, I think, probably universally among people who leave religion. That was something that was really hard. But there's a kind of shunning that can happen, as is common among other religions.
Well, they don't want to get contaminated. I think that's something to be said, is like, they think that you're evil and you're going to bring them down with you. So like, I'm sure people, like, when they were like, oh my gosh, Terry's hanging out with Ryan, they probably thought like, oh, like, you know, who brought who down or whatever. But like, it's definitely an interesting thing. Yeah, it's not easy. Yeah, you can lose everything because like I said, this between your school, if all your friends and family, you know, are all in that little enclave, it is like leaving a full-on community.
I think the hardest thing for me personally was and this is not true for everyone, of course, wouldn't be true for Terry necessarily, but all of my education all the way through my doctorate is in like theology and church leadership. My career up to the age of 42 or 3, whatever I was when I left, I had no plan B. I'm not a carpenter on the side. You know, I don't secretly have like a teaching credential, you know? So I was really economically, the hardest thing for me was I didn't have any income. I didn't have a job. And the funny thing too was that when I started my blog, everybody, including atheists, would say, oh, he's writing, you know, he's already made up his mind to be an atheist. He's just doing this blog to make a buck. And I can tell you, after 7 years, I've still not made a buck. And could use a few more, actually, to pay off some debts, you know, that I accrued over those period of time, because I didn't have any way to survive economically. And I think that's real for people. I mean, sometimes they lose even their jobs.
Yeah, I've read like a lot of people online who were pastors and that was their way of living, who then realized that they didn't have, you know, that belief in God anymore. And they continued being pastors because that was the only way that they could make money, which I think is just incredible, like, in a bad way, obviously.
Yeah, you're not trained for anything else for such a long time. I mean, you really are told to devote your life and your to the service, and that's it. It can leave people very crippled. And I know some people, I'm sure, who want to get out and are kind of feeling trapped or stuck, because also family is so important, you know, and that's something you don't want to lose either. And I feel like a lot of people do lose that.
No, it sounds like the church really paints a scary picture of what the world is like outside of the SDA congregants. It's not like the SDA belief system. Like, if you're not a Seventh-day Adventist, it sounds like the world is then evil and scary and just crazy. And so that would keep people staying in the church and also make it hard to get out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's definitely, I used to point out that we sing these two hymns in the church. This is my father's world. I don't know if any of you raised religious or sang hymns. This is my father. I used to give a sermon about this when I would travel to different places, which is a celebration of creation, essentially, the beautiful world that we have. And then there's another song, this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through, which is actually an old Negro spiritual. And when you kind of understand the context, you can clearly understand why a person might embrace a belief system that had them get headed to somewhere better. But then ripped from that context, it becomes, you know, a theology of escapism where this world doesn't matter because we're going to go somewhere else. And that world is scary and doomed to fail. And the more it fails, the more it's a sign that Jesus is coming soon. Mm. And it's very defeatist and fatalistic and really ultimately disempowering to people. They aren't enlisted in their own emancipation. And it's just, it's really unfortunate.
What are some famous Seventh-day Adventists? You mentioned Ben Carson and also the Kellogg, early Kellogg families. What?
Little Richard is one of my favorites. He went to...
Little Richard?
Yeah, he would still go to church sometimes around here in the LA area when he was
Rest
around.
In peace.
Rest in peace, Little Richard. But yeah, he beautifully complicated. You know, Malcolm X spent some time in the Adventist church. As well as Prince spent some time little bit with J-Dubs and the Adventist Church. So some of your favorite artists complicated relationships with the church, all of those guys.
Magic Johnson was raised in an Adventist family. I don't know if he as an adult ever embraced it. Someone in the chat said Barry Black. I don't know. That actually might be a relative of Terry. I don't know. Is this your
No.
family? No. It's just another gamble. Barry Black is the chaplain of the Senate.
No, I didn't know so about I've seen a lot of like Adventist hospitals around.
Yes.
Is that the same thing as a Seventh-day Adventist?
Yes.
Or is it?
Yeah, I'm telling you, there's
really?
A ton of hospitals, tons of schools. Yeah.
That's a big moneymaker, it sounds like.
Well, it's where a lot of people work. And also, it's like I said, it's a place to kind of proselytize. And also, if you're offering healing, they really are, I think, focused on the good parts of it is really focused on like doing the work of Jesus as far as like really being there for the sick and needy is a really big mission of the church. And that's something I still adhere to even as a non-member of the church at the moment. Do you know what I mean, though? Of really trying to be supportive of people in the community in that aspect. So,
yeah, and they're legit hospitals. They're nonprofit hospitals, so they're not for-profit healthcare institutions. And they also don't, to my knowledge at least, don't engage in the whole like Catholic hospitals scenario where they'll deny people birth control and they'll deny people family planning services. I don't know about abortions. I do know that they are not, they'll treat everyone.
Okay. What is their stance on birth control?
It's not an issue.
Okay.
Yeah. And the abortion issue is anti-abortion, but, you know, interesting is we don't have enough time to go into it all here, but for reasons, the Adventist Church doesn't go in on the whole, religious right abortion legislation thing. So you'll find on the church website, you know, stances on different social issues, and they'll say, you know, Adventists don't support abortion, but you won't find them at like right to life rallies and stuff.
I think that's partly because Adventists, like I said, historically, I was surprised that people got involved in politics because they really are about that separation of church and state, almost more so than some other secularists in certain ways, just because they're so worried about the end times and like the end times of the world is they feel like they're going to be forced to have to worship on Sabbath on Sunday versus Saturday, and that they're going to be forced to like have like a mark of the beast and all these things are going to happen that are going to be coming from the government or the state. So anything that's state sanctioned through the government to go against their religion is problematic.
Perfect. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think that is going to be the end of the actual like the session. So if it's okay with you guys, we can jump to the Q&A section.
Sure.
Yeah, guys, thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to go ahead and drop the resources that they provided into the chat. And I also want to kind of, if you want to get in touch with them, I've got some links that they've provided for us as well. Yeah, so this was fantastic. Thank you so much, guys. But we have got quite a few questions. It was great. Amaya, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so there's someone who is asking something that's connected to the abortion thing. I'm just trying to read it through and understand it, because I'm not sure if I understand the question correctly. But okay, so it's they're saying that they're anti-abortion, the Seventh-day Adventists, but that they think it's okay in some extreme cases. It says because they think that they will come where the state will oppress them. So wouldn't they want that to come true? I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Yeah, there is a tension there between the end time scenario, which is as the more we're oppressed, the more it means Jesus is coming soon, but also sticking up for our, like, your rights as, you know, so freedom of religion. And I think there are a slight division within the church. There are people that are more apocalyptic who, but I was never taught as an Adventist that we should wish for the time of trouble or that we should wish for things to get really bad, just that it was going to. And when it does, it means that, A, that you're doing something right. Like, you wouldn't be persecuted if you were going with the flow. Like, only people that stand against the tide of the culture are going to be persecuted, and it and God is on your side. But it's never like a death wish.
Got it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And then someone asks, which I think is really funny, if Jesus Christ showed up, what would be the sign that he has arrived? Do they have like a list of things?
Well, every eye is supposed to see him and every knee shall bow. That's like what's supposed to happen. So I was like, oh, it's going to be on TV, like, or something where everybody's supposed to see him at the same time. So if we don't all see him at the same time, it didn't happen.
Okay.
We also
have a revelation.
Yeah, you would literally see him. So it would be like visible on a round globe. Like, you would, like, you know, we don't all see the same stars in the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere, but somehow if Jesus was coming, everybody in the globe would somehow be able to see him. And we also used to have this funny thing that, because there's also a teaching in the church that there would be counterfeit Christs. And the Bible also talks about counterfeit Christs who would come and claim to be the Son of God and the second coming. And we see this in the news all the time, people claiming to be Jesus. And I was taught, and I don't remember quite where this comes from, but that the real Jesus would not touch the earth. He would hover above the earth. Because the earth has to be cleansed by fire first before Jesus can actually...
The earth made new.
But it was just such a fine, like, nuanced point. Like, just remember to look and see if his feet are touching the ground, and that's how you'll know.
Yeah, so that's why we know all these other false Jesus have already happened.
Doesn't Chris Angel kind of levitate?
David Blaine as well does a little levitating too, so I don't know. Maybe that's Jesus. I was just saying, there's been offshoots. I know that was one of the questions I think you guys had in here too. The Branch Davidians were like seven offshoots off. The David Koresh was like an offshoot of an offshoot of an offshoot of an offshoot of Seventh-day Adventism as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You're welcome.
So it was like a grandchild or a great-grandchild of SDA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was epic. I mean, I was in late years of my college when the whole conflagration happened in Waco, Texas, and it was like, oh no, I was a pastor already or a student pastor or something. And I remember the conference, the number one talking point from the communications department was, be sure first of all, don't speak to the press, tell them to call us, right? That's what every corporation says. And if you do speak to the press, just emphasize that they are not us, right? Because everybody
it was a
making,
PR problem because people were making that equation. Yeah.
Huge PR problem. Yeah.
Yep.
We have another question here. What's the difference, or are SDAs the same as YECs? I don't know what YEC stands for.
Young Earth Creationists. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I get it.
Yeah. So yeah, we are, they are among the Young Earth Creationists. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't believe in dinosaurs as a kid. Like, they were a hoax from the devil.
That's one of my most favorite, like, conspiracy theories, that dinosaurs never existed. I think that's just so hilarious.
It was so crazy because I loved that part at Disneyland. There's like a like train that takes you through like past these like cool dinosaur thing. And I'd be like, oh, those are so cool though. But like, too bad. Those are like the people, like the devil tried to fool us into thinking that the world is older than it is. That's the justification. I love Gail's face. Yes, Gail.
It's really funny. Yeah.
So there's a very specific question here from a former SDA. What is the three angels' message and unique end time prophecies of the SDA church? And how does this kind of relate to the people who leave the church? The three angels message makes no sense to me.
So it's a passage from Revelation 14, if I'm not mistaken. And it basically, the three angels carry warnings to the earth at the very end of time, basically warning people that the hour of judgment is coming and that they need to repent and turn from their evil ways. And in the end, join the Adventist Church. It doesn't say that in Revelation 14, but basically
that's
we're
what
the ones
in Revelation seminars that was like, that's the thing to get people into the church too.
Yeah. So we're the ones who figured this out. So if you want to avoid being deceived, you have to. The interesting thing about Adventists, though, is that they stopped one step short of saying only Adventists would be saved. The issue was that if you weren't an Adventist, there was a very high likelihood that you would be deceived. So you don't want to take that risk. And so you want to be with the people who have figured this out, but you won't really hear Adventists say only Adventists will be saved. In fact, that's kind of like a straw man that Adventists are prepared for. Like, I remember people tonight,
really?
Like, oh, you're just saying that only Adventists will be saved. And I'm like, no. We're gospel Christians. If you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ with all your heart, you'll be saved. However, you need to be faithful to the end. And you can't be faithful to the end unless you're, prepared for the deceptions that will come. There were people that even wished that they would die before the end times and be saved rather than like, they're like, oh, I'm so glad so-and-so passed away when they did. I just don't think they would have made it through the end times, if, you know, the Great Tribulation.
They wouldn't get they wouldn't make it through the tests. They wouldn't make it through the tests and trials. Yeah.
Saved from what exactly in the chat? It's like saved from hellfire. Like, an Adventist, to be clear, and we should point this out because we haven't said this yet. Adventists don't believe in an ever burning hell. But they do believe that hell is a moment in time where all things are destroyed by fire. Some people believe literal. Some people, it just is a metaphor for destruction. So sometimes I would be doing sort of Bible studies with people when they wanted to join the church, and I was like, no, we don't believe in eternal hellfire. Oh, really? So what do you know? Yeah, we're annihilationists, what are known as annihilationists, which means that when you're just killed once and then you're dead. There's no suffering, except for whatever suffering might be involved in your death. And then you're just, and then what? You know, a person would say, well, then what? Like, nothing, because we also don't believe that you're, as Carrie mentioned earlier, we don't believe in the soul living on outside the body. So it's just unconsciousness, like just dead, gone.
Like asleep. They call
like
it
the way that we all believe what happens when you die. And my friend, one of my friends said, oh, that's so much more comforting, you know, like that I just am, you know, eternally gone. But yeah, so that's a distinction that Adventists, and it's weird because there are not a lot of Christians who actually believed that until recently. The evangelicals have kind of gone that route. It was a big heresy, actually, in the Society of Evangelical Theologians, where a couple of theologians said, yeah, you know what? Eternal hellfire is not biblical, which the Adventists had been saying for a century or more.
Well, they equated it to like the fire that ended Sodom and Gomorrah in the Bible, because that fire stopped. Okay. They said it's going to be the same type of fire. An absolution in that scenario, but just for the whole planet instead of just for those cities.
So if you're not a believer, you just big sleep. But if you are a believer, you go to heaven?
More or less. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a complicated scenario in the Adventist eschatology. Like there's a first resurrection and a second resurrection. So if you die and you're a believer, you'll be resurrected to new life.
Okay.
If you die and you're not a believer, you'll be resurrected to be killed again in hellfire. It's like
super fun.
Yeah, you'll be resurrected. Literally, when you read it in Revelation, it's like they were all resurrected, and the God's people ascend into heaven with him, and then hellfire rains down from heaven and burns everybody up. So you really just literally woke someone up to say it's time to go to sleep. Like it's, you know, like. Wake up. Okay, now you're going to die. Like, just leave me dead. Like,
it's wild.
It's really crazy. And that is kind of a unique scenario. Like, those of you in the that are here tonight that know about dispensationalism and the different ways that the end of the world scenarios that different evangelicals have, like, it's the rapture idea is that God's people are whisked out of here and only the bad people suffer. And then there's another version of that where we all suffer, but God's people are saved in the end. And this is like a third way, which is I can't make it out right now. Sorry.
But right, yeah, there's suffering, like a, and then some people, yeah, there's more suffering.
But we're definitely post-tribulation. If people are keeping score at home, like the Adventists are post-tribulation. So believers are not saved from the agony of temptation and suffering. We live through it like everybody else, but we're saved in the end.
And cool. What about like, I know that when I went to church every Sunday, we would be, they pass around an offering plate and we would have,
oh, yeah,
10%.
Adventists tithe hard. And if you don't, they'll come find you.
Oh, really?
Full 10%. They have tithing envelopes because people, like, that's the one thing. They're like, God will provide as long as you pay that 10%. You need to make sure. It's pretty standard.
One of the things that I had a friend who had a roommate who was religious, and they connected their bank account to the church, and the church would take out some funds, and it would like overdrew his account, and he had to pay fees for the open. And it was like, it was scary. Like, I felt my heart went out to that person. Is that something they do? And I would imagine it's something they would do in the SDA church too. Like, hook your bank account up to our tithing system.
I was there during the manual days, and I'm a Luddite, okay. So no.
You're a Luddite.
But I would write my check, you know, and like whenever I could do my 10%, I would do my 10%.
We used to actually joke about passing a credit card swiper down the aisle as if that was like a hilarious thing that nobody could ever imagine. And now, of course, you go to a restaurant and they bring the credit card swiper to your table. Back when we used to go to restaurants, if you remember. And now I can totally imagine that. Like, pass the debit machine down and enter your PIN number.
Or do an automatic auto pay. I'm sure there's got to be places that have it set up at this point.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. Like, I think it's funny. Somebody, I think in chat, I know we're not supposed to read it, but I was like, but talking about like Scientology or whatever, that was another reason why I left the church. I remember reading so much about like people going into debt or like, you know, feeling like they needed to pay. And I just remember like very distinctly having moments like in college or just during times when tithes were very tight and making that decision to pay my tithe because I needed God to bless me more than I needed to get like food that week or whatever. Do you know what I mean though? Because I know I could go to potluck or go to somebody's house and probably get a plate of something. Do you know what I mean though? Like, I just felt like God would provide if I was diligent with my tithing.
Yeah, and there were these myths about it that were peddled around the church. I mean, these were like really larger than life mythologies about people who gave their last dollar, like the widow's mite in the Gospels. And then, you know, out of nowhere, a bag of groceries would show up on their doorstep, or suddenly, right when they needed it, like a $500 check would show up in their mail and they have no idea where it came from. And they just knew that because they were faithful, God blessed them.
Yep.
And, but then, you know, these are like, you know, I forget what I'm sure many of you in the session here tonight will know exactly what this is. I forget the name of it, but there's like a logical fallacy, where you count the hits and not the misses. Like, so like every time your prayer is answered, it's like, ooh, my prayer was answered, but you're not really paying attention to every time the prayer wasn't answered, which is way, way more times. So yeah, confirmation bias, or there's also, yeah, the sharpshooter fallacy. So you just think that if you count the hits and not the misses, you can actually, your brain will be like, oh, see there, like that's an answer to prayer.
Right.
And nobody's ever, like, I remember the first time we had these bedtime stories that were written by one of the patriarchs of the church. And they would tell the story of, you know, the little boy whose you know, parents were very sick, and he went to church and he prayed and his parents were healed. And it suddenly hit me one day, I think I was in college, when I was like, what about the people who pray and their parents aren't healed? Like, what is that about? But we just don't talk about those, you know, we just only talk about the ones that work out, and that builds the faith in the system. And you don't know, because God's ways are mysterious, right? God has mysterious ways. And if God doesn't answer the prayer, it just means wait, or it just means no. And then we had this Ellen White quote that said, if you could see the end from the beginning as God can, you would not wish for anything to have happened differently than it's happened in your life. Mm-hmm. I butchered it a little bit, but that's really what it said.
That's that perfect. Great. Thank you.
I'm putting it on my wallpaper.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for questions. So thank you so, so much to both of you.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope,
healing and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.